Good morning. I'd like to call to order the June meeting of the California Water Commission. We'll start off with a roll call.
Oh, that was very tricky. Good morning. Commissioner Ball.
Present.
Commissioner, Chairman, no, Commissioner Byrne. Absent. Commissioner Curtin.
Here.
Commissioner Del Bosque.
Here.
Commissioner Daniels. Commissioner Herrera. Commissioner Orth.
Here.
Commissioner Quintero.
Present.
We have a quorum. I'd like to mention a couple things before we get started, that we do have speaker cards available for members of the public who would like to make a statement or present to the commission. The cards are outside. Rachel Belanti here will collect the cards, and she'll be checking periodically in the audience to see if you have cards. Speakers will be called one at a time. Staff will call the name of the current speaker and the name of the next speaker so you can prepare for your turn at the mic. We'll make every effort to call the speakers in the order that the cards were received, but that can't be guaranteed. So, thank you.
Okay, we'll have the approval of the minutes next. If anybody has any corrections or comments on the minutes.
Move approval.
We have a motion and a second, we'll have a roll call on that.
Commissioner Ball.
Yes.
Commissioner Curtin.
Yes.
Commissioner Del Bosque.
Yes.
Commissioner Orth.
Yes.
Commissioner Quintero.
Yes.
Approved.
Okay, we'll go to the executive officer's report. I would like to say, I want to say thank you to the Santa Clara Valley Water District for offering us their facilities, and welcome the folks from the Central Coast here to our meeting. And I also want to say welcome to our new executive officer, Paula.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. I have a couple of items on the executive officer's report. The first one is that in your binder, you'll find a proposed model landscape ordinance regulations. They're being drafted pursuant to Governor Brown's April 1st drought executive order B-2915. The terms of the order being promulgated as emergency regulations with the bypass of the Office of Administrative Law Review. However, this commission has the responsibility for approving those regulations, which are currently out for public review. Staff are investigating the deadline for approval by the commission in order to schedule a briefing. Because these regulations are on an expedited path, it's a little different calendar and scheduling than we would normally anticipate for drafting and approving of regulations. On the topic of Water Commission staffing issues. I'm currently assessing the staffing needs. I have spoken with DWR personnel and asking that the attorney for position be advertised, and I'm developing a duty statement for the program manager position one. That's what I have for my executive officer report. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay, we have some opening remarks by Commissioner Ball and Commissioner Quintero.
Thank you. It's great to be down here. Start off the day by talking to Bo Goldie, and we have the pleasure of sitting on the Water Committee for the Bay Area Council. We've also spoken at a couple of different events. I'd say it's always enlightening to hear Bo speak, and it's one of the things that I was looking forward to in coming down here today. I am active in the Silicon Valley Leadership Group as the chair of their water policy. And 2 weeks ago, I had the good fortune to be able to take a tour of the water treatment facility in South San Jose. And I have to say that is an impressive facility. And walking through that and seeing that you're taking 12% of the treated water from the waste treatment plant nearby and producing 8 million gallons of near potable water that goes into groundwater recharge is a thing of beauty. To find new water that was just being dumped into the bay, is something we should all strive for, and I understand you're going to triple the capacity of that, and that is fantastic. I think that is an example that all of the other water districts should look at as a way to find new water. So I commend you on that, and I look forward to your presentation, and I'm very glad to be down there today. Thank you.
I'd also like to say thank you for hosting us, and I'd really like to extend my thanks to the district. The chair of the board, Gary Kremen, hosted me here along with some of your staff several weeks ago, Bo, and I got an overview of the district as well as a tour as well of the water purification plant. And I really think that this district represents a wonderful model for California water districts and irrigation districts in terms of really thinking about how they can rethink their portfolios. And as Commissioner Ball said, it's a time to find new water. And it's right, as you have done, it's right in your own backyard in many cases. And thank you so much for hosting us. And I'd also like to welcome Supervisor Cortese. Thanks for being here. And really looking forward to the day. Thanks.
Okay. Item six, we're going to have some public testimony. And we'd like to invite elected officials to come forward and give us some remarks. I'd like to start off, first of all, with Chairman of the Board, Gary Kremen.
Good morning, Chair and members of the Commission. My name is Gary Kremen. I'm the Chair of the Water District, Santa Clara Valley Water District. Thanks for coming to Silicon Valley. And it really is our pleasure to host you here. I'm going to start this presentation today. We're going to tell you a little bit about what we do and then kind of jump in some of the details. Then I'm going to turn it over to Supervisor Cortese as a couple remarks, and we'll then jump and talk about some of the innovations that we've done here that we hope can serve as a model for the state. So this is what we do. Just real quick, I know you're probably familiar with this, but we actually do three things. We do more than just water supply. We do flood protection. We keep our creeks. We're the environmental steward of our creeks and some of the watersheds and things like that. And our goal is to kind of, in Silicon Valley, kind of a holistic approach, all things water. We serve a little bit over 2 million people in some of the biggest economic job creators in the state, 15 cities and towns. We sell our water to wholesalers, plus we have well owners, 4,700 well owners. We have 13 water retailers. Some are investor-owned, some are in municipalities, even special districts, and we got a bunch of watersheds. So that's the overview. So now I'm going to turn it over to Supervisor Cortese. Then our CEO is going to go through a lot of details on how it relates, and then I'll help wrap it up. So again, welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chair Kremen, and I want to thank the Commission, the Chair, for extending me an invitation to come here today, in part to welcome all of you to the County of Santa Clara, a county with a population of about 1.8 million people. That today, of course, is much more known for technology and gross domestic product that is generating, as a metropolitan area, it's generating more per capita gross domestic product than any metropolitan area in the world, according to Forbes' most recent report. Yet we're still a county that has 15,000 agricultural employees. So we are not only producing in this county apples and iPhones, we are producing still fruit on the tree, and we have a whole bunch of people dependent on that economy as well. I'm keenly aware of that, not only as president of the Board of Supervisors and as a person who's been elected official here for 23 years, I had my own form of osmosis because my father chaired Water Parks and Wildlife in the state legislature for 16 years, and coming from an agricultural family that planted itself here 100 years ago, I've seen this partial transition, if you will, in the economy to the more urban economy we have now, never forgetting that we are still one of the largest agricultural counties in the state of California, which makes this, I think, not only a model county for you to look at and a model district for you to look at, but perhaps a microcosm of the many issues that you're seeing on a statewide basis. We know that you're here primarily to talk about and to gain testimony on Prop 1 and the Groundwater Management Act, we encourage you to do that. If there's anything that we can do through elected official outreach here to get you more input, be that by email, I think the Board of Supervisors alone, the five of us have somewhere in the neighborhood of 300,000 or 400,000 emails in the county of Santa Clara. We're happy to continue this process and view this as just a start of the outreach process if that's indeed what you would like to have happen. Just let us know where you'd like that input to go, and we'll make sure that that happens. There are many things going on here, of course, that you've already heard about, that you'll hear about more today. The leadership of this district, in my opinion, has done a tremendous job, not only getting out in front of the drought, but in fact, encouraging conservation here to the point where we are using less water here now, despite growing population, than we have in years past. That is an achievement in and of itself and really sets a standard for where we want to go. I know the director, Bo Goldie, who again has certainly exerted tremendous leadership, will detail their efforts. I was privy as a regional leader to hear his presentation recently. Want you to know that we are committed at the Santa Clara County Board of Supervisors, in conjunction with the board here at the Water District and regional leaders, particularly throughout the eastern part of the region, to continue looking not only at water purification but at other technologies. There's desal technologies that are already in progress in portions of this region, and we've established a working group, an ad hoc working group, to pursue and explore those technologies, knowing that we do indeed have examples of desalination at a large scale that have made it through the CEQA process that are in fact going forward in the state of California. We want to make sure in a region where we have 600,000 housing units planned just on the next planning horizon in our adopted plan that we're able to keep up with that kind of growth in our region and do our fair share. Thank you. Please stay connected with us. We want to stay connected with you. And thank you for honoring me with a few minutes to welcome you and to make some opening remarks.
Good morning. My name is Bo Goldie. I'm CEO of Santa Clara Valley Water District, and wanted to welcome you here today. It's a great honor to have you here today, and we're going to be presenting some information. I'm going to run through some slides pretty quickly. Don't hesitate to ask questions as we go through this. I know we got a 20-minute time frame, which is probably down about 15 minutes now, so I'll go fairly quickly. So we serve the entire Santa Clara County. Over the years, we have emerged with a number of minor or smaller water agencies and created to where we are today. We, as it was indicated, we do not only water supply, we do flood protection. This is a diagram. You should have a packet. If somebody could hold up what that packet looks like. Rick, do you have the federal packet? And this is the packet that provides a lot of detailed description and information. Now, we'll get staff to hold it up. It's the federal appropriations. You don't need to look at it now. The bottom line is we do flood protection. We go back to D.C. every year trying to get funding for the Army Corps to bring some funding to Santa Clara County. We have a large number of projects. We have at least 8 projects that are going with the federal government to move these. One of the major ones is the Shoreline Project, which will provide tidal flood protection, which is a project that's going to go in the it should be in your packets. A document that looks like this. And what we're, one of our major projects is a shoreline project, and you can see where San Francisco Bay is on this diagram, and the upper, that little red line there, not the red line, but right in that area, there's a project with the Army Corps of Engineers to provide tidal flood protection, as well as restoration of the South Bay salt pond marshes that are there that used to be owned by Cargill. You're aware we are in a drought. Santa Clara County, we get 55% of our water supply is imported. 15% of that comes from Hetch Hetchy through the northern portion of the county. The remaining 40% actually flows through the Delta. We're unique in that we are both a federal CVP and a state water project contractor. 30% of our water supply is local. Basically, that is the 10 reservoirs that we own and operate. We use that for recharge. We have 5% recycled water within the county, and we have demand management, which is 10% of the conservation right now. Where does the water, how do we use our water? You can see from this diagram, most of the water used in Santa Clara County is residential. The remaining portion is business 31%, plus I would add the 6% of dedicated meter landscape. That is for large businesses like Google and Yahoo that have large landscapes. They have their own meters. So I would add that to 37% is really industrial uses. And agriculture. In the southern portion of Santa Clara County, it's primary agriculture uses down there. In the northern portion, we're more urban. We have a very integrative system that was built over many years. It started around the 29 and the 30s, where we started constructing reservoirs and recharge facilities. We have 10 reservoirs, 3 pump stations, 800 miles of stream that we manage, 142 miles of pipeline, and you can see there's quite a number of things. If you look at the last one, we have one advanced water purification center. That is the our latest addition to our operations, our water supply, and that is a purification center where we actually take recycled water, treat it to drinking water quality standards, and that's a pilot program we had put in place, been operational for a year. We're looking to expand that and expand that threefold. But we cover the entire county. You can see that we bring water in from the CVP, from the San Luis Reservoir, up, which is actually, once we pump it to the top of Pacheco Pass, it is gravity-fed all the way to Los Gatos for our treatment plant. We also bring in South Bay Aqueduct through Milpitas, which is, goes to our penitentiary facility, and that is actually brought in, and we use that for not only treatment, but we use both of those waters for recharge. This is a diagram I'll spend a few minutes on. This is a diagram that actually comes from real live well data. It actually started with engineers bringing to me the well data information. We convert it into something that the public can really understand. It tells the story of the water district, and it tells the story of the importance of the groundwater basin we have. If you look at this on the vertical axis, you'll see it's the elevation. That is depth of water. Horizontal axis is 1900 to 2000 time. You see the little brown line there with the barn on it and the houses. That is the land surface. The green line is population increase. And then the blue line is, of course, depth of water. It was back in 1929 that this community was primarily agriculture. There was a lot of agriculture community that was overdrafting the groundwater basin. And it was really at 29 when it was realized that the ground was beginning to subside. It subsided 4 feet in 1929. That's when the water district was created for the purposes of constructing reservoirs and the recharge system. That was innovative, high-tech back in the 30s. Those reservoirs were constructed. You can see the blue line as it drops down. The reservoirs were actually constructed about in the 30s. They were operational, probably about 32, 33. And you can see the groundwater recovering. You can see that bump going up with the blue line. That is a recovery of the groundwater basin. If you compare that with the brown line, subsidence was arrested for a few years there. No more subsidence. Then what happened was the population. After World War II, the population boomed. See the green line going up. Demand on the groundwater basin increased. We hit our lowest point down there about 1965, and that was actually the time when the State Water Project came online. That's when we were starting to import the first water supply that we had. The groundwater basin recovered, and you can see that we started to decline in the late 80s, which was around that last drought, and the significant drought we had. Federal water came online, the groundwater recovered. What's significant about this graph are two things. One, it wasn't until 1970 that groundwater subsidence was arrested. The ground in downtown San Jose has sunk 13 feet. Today, if that subsidence occurs, we will have significant infrastructure impacts. All of our sanitary lines, all of the stormwater lines, the flood protection projects, are all at risk if subsidence begins again. We also have our three wastewater treatment plants owned by Centerville, Palo Alto, and San Jose that are right on the bay. If subsidence occurs again, and it has, our Alviso community has sunk 10 feet, that they're at a greater risk for tidal flooding, and with climate change, they're at a greater risk. So this is the most important thing that we're trying to deal with and manage within the Santa Clara County. It is significant. So here comes the concern. If you look at the red arrow, in 1 year, our groundwater elevation has dropped 33 feet. That is 80,000 acre feet of water. To put that in perspective, we use somewhere around 326,000 a year on an average year. So it is starting to have an impact. So we took that information and we compared that. One of our first responses to dealing with the drought is conservation. We've been very aggressive in promoting conservation, not only turf replacement, but getting the message out. This is our water shortage contingency plan. You can see from this particular plan that on the vertical axis, you got the blue bar and then you got the red bar. There's increased risks of subsidence. It doesn't occur at once. These are not sinkholes. This is the entire valley floor sinking down. So we projected out where are we going to be depending upon various levels of conservation. If we have 0% conservation, which we won't, we anticipate that we would see subsidence occurring of significant proportions later on fiscal year 15 or calendar year 15. Last year, our board called for a 20% conservation level. We got 13%. If we continue down that pathway, we can anticipate that we're going to see subsidence later on in 2016. If we get 20% subsidence, or it's 20% conservation, we will be seeing a subsidence really to begin around 2019. Our board in March called for 30% conservation, which is above what the governor, what the State Water Resources Control Board has called for. And the reason is this. The reason is subsidence that we're trying to protect for this groundwater basin. So we talked about IPR, indirect potable resource, our purification line. We are looking to accelerate that, and I'll talk about that in a minute. If we're able to do that, we will get an initial 35,000 acre feet that we can put in the groundwater basin. This is the project that we are driving to move quickly to, because we do not know how long this drought's going to last, but we need to get ready for that. So as you are well aware, supplies are increasingly scarce. Our imported allocations were 20 and 25% CVP State Water Project. Our reservoirs are at 49% storage. Now, that's a little higher than what you would see normally because we're trying to have as much in those for carryover and how much we can provide our surface water users as well as our groundwater basin. I mentioned the groundwater is down 80,000 acre feet in 1 year. So we have a comprehensive strategy that we put together. I will draw your attention to this document here. You should have that in your packet. This is a report that we have been presenting to the board for about 18 months now. Every month we go to the board with this report, and this is updated. It presents a lot of very valuable information. In the back, on page 43, it talks about the 15 strategies. So while the drought has a significant impact, we're trying to take advantage of the drought. We have moved our conservation program. We have a lot of outreach that's going on. The community in Santa Clara County, 98% of the people are aware that there is a drought. If we were talking a number of years ago about water supply, it wasn't on anybody's radar. Turn on the tap, this endless supply of water comes out. And on our flip side, if there's no floodwaters in their living room when they wake up in the morning, they're happy. They're busy on their day-to-day. So it's hard to get their attention. We have their attention. They are aware. 98%. I don't know where the 2% is. They're under a rock someplace. But in any event, we make some substantial progress in getting that awareness. So we put 15 strategies. Those are the basic, secure our imported supplies. It is accelerate our conservation awareness program, accelerate our conservation measures like turf replacement. But we also took advantage of this. We took advantage of the drought because our perk ponds are dry. We have percolation ponds that we haven't seen for decades. We have gone in and we have cleaned all 400 acres of those perk ponds. So we have been substantial there. We are doing repairs on our dams that are at low levels. We are doing maintenance on facilities that don't have water, and this is the time to actually take care of them. So we've been very aggressive in doing that. We also have making sure that we demonstrate our own conservation measures. This campus has all drought-tolerant plants. We've been very conservative originally. Our staff squeezed out another 31% conservation out of the facilities that we have here, which is great, so we can demonstrate that. The other innovative approach that we're taking with the drought is the awareness of drought, but we're actually moving staff around in the organization to deal with the drought. Last time there was a drought, most of those, except for us old guys, were not here. They're all gone. So we're moving staff around the organization, taking people from accounting to help respond to drought calls. We now have 30 people focusing just on response to calls that come in on the drought and turf replacement programs and what people can do. I mentioned that the board had called for 30%. We are, I don't know if I report later on. I'll tell you the results later on. We're securing our imported water. One of the challenges in terms of getting the information out there and making the getting the community to really respond is consistency. Within the county, we have 15 cities that we support. And each city comes up with their own little ordinance and days of watering, and it gets very confusing for the public. I'm pleased to report that in Santa Clara County, we got 2 days of watering for everybody. And our retailers and the municipalities are working well together to provide consistency. We had a summit. We had a summit with the elected officials, and we had a summit with the retailers to have this kind of conversation and how can we be consistent. This is actually taking us to a point where we are looking at more innovative ways to take care of the drought. For the future, we are actually going to be looking at on-site systems. Some of you may be familiar with what San Francisco has done. We're looking to take that program for some large facilities and actually be essentially self-contained, which you won't have the demand on the water supply, and you may not have the demand on the wastewater side. So that awareness is there. We're working collectively with all the cities in order to do that. We are going to pursue a permanent solution, and let me go back to the permanent solution point. I mentioned a couple of times, I won't get into it, is our advanced purification center. So this document was put together that lays out what we're planning to do with our purification center. We are going to go from the 8 MGD facility, we're going to actually be creating 45,000 acre feet of drought-proof supplies from our recycle program. This is an aggressive schedule to move this thing forward. We're looking for ways to continue to move it through processes. Permits is one of the issues, as all of permitting can be a challenge. Funding, we expect this to cost, our current estimate is about $800 million. I will tell you the board has been very supportive of moving this along, and the community has been very supportive. We have the mayor of San Jose and the mayor of Santa Clara also very engaged with this, as well as just about every elected official I talked to within the county. So that's for your looking later on. If you would like to have a tour of that facility, as Mr. Ball has indicated, we'd be more than happy to provide that to you. So our conservation, our innovation. So we have water conservation research grants. So we have actually provided funding to the community on innovative ideas. So we can actually leverage some of those ideas, the ones that work. Sometimes they just need some initial funding to be able to move those along. And I'll give you a couple of indicators of what. We just awarded 5 grants. One with San Jose Water Company for advanced metering infrastructure for single-family residents. We have, with a private entity, BKI, awarded $50,000 for their employee rewards program to get people to conserve. Cedar Morgan Hill has a new lawn irrigation technology that they're testing. So this provides that seed money, and if these actually systems work, they can then be expanded in the future. We have water waste inspectors. So one of the big challenges is educating the public. Some people get it, some people don't. We have our communication staff have created an app so people can actually inform us when there is some wastage going on. We can then send out an inspector that can knock on the door and help educate the individuals to what they can do. Some people still won't get it. The retailers are the ones who will take the necessary enforcement actions. We are looking for the legislator and the governor to help provide authorities to the water district that can backstop those cities if some cities are not comfortable with taking those actions. Consistent countywide watershed, I talked about that. Landscape rebate program has been very, very popular. We have, and I think it's on the next slide, replaced over 2 million square feet of turf. Gray water program is one that we provide funding. Here it is. So our turf conversion program, we provide $2 a square foot. Some cities match that. Palo Alto matches another $2 a square foot. So Morgan Hill matches, I think, another $2 also. So we have seen an 800% increase in that participation. 2.5 million, which is 57 acres of turf, have been replaced in Santa Clara County. Everybody is eligible. It's not just residents. Homeowners, businesses, public agencies. Gray water rebate program. So we provide rebates for those who are interested in putting gray water systems. As you are probably aware, it's closed from your sink, from your washer that is used for irrigation, your landscape. So it saves about 14,000 acre feet per year, and the rebate is about $200. The systems, I think, cost around $800. Did I misspeak there? 14,000 gallons. I'm used to acre feet. When they throw gallons in on me, it messes me up. Okay, gallons. I wish it was acre feet. So here's our purified water system. So we have an 8MGD facility that we're operating. We're taking that water, putting it back into the recycled system to get higher quality recycled water. Our plans are to expand that facility, as I mentioned. We have five projects within that group. We are going to take that water and bring it upstream to our recharge facilities. Most of our recharge facilities are on the foot of the hills because that's where the geology is best. You can't really recharge down by the bay. So we're going to be bringing that water up and putting in the existing recharge facilities. We are looking at an injection well also. We hope to have this whole program operational in the next 4 years, 5 years. We're driving this as quickly as we can. And this is one of the drought-proof supplies, new supply of water that we're going to be able to do. In this county, we have already evaluated. Ultimate build-out for recycled water is about 80,000 acre-feet if we were to work on all the systems. This is one component. We're working in South County with the city of SCRA, which is an agency down there that deals with their wastewater system. We're working with Palo Alto, and we're working with the city of Sunnyvale. And in fact, the city of Sunnyvale and the water district, Cal Water and Apple Computer, are building a recycled line up to the new Apple campus, and they'll be using recycled water. Apple has contributed funding. We have contributed funding. It's a great partnership that shows how you can get private and you can investor-owned as well as public agencies working together to help accelerate some of these programs.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
This advanced purification system is doing about 8 million gallons a day, and then switching to acre feet, so I'm just trying to get the math. Is it like tripling the capabilities
Yeah. It's a little more than tripling the facility that we have there, because the facility is an 8MGD. When we start folding in some of the work we're doing in Sunnyvale, it bumps it up
okay,
a little bit.
Okay, so is that where the $800 million investment, did you say $800 million?
I said $800 million.
It will be in that facility or a variety of?
No, the $800 million is just to construct those five projects that expand that purification center that bring the water up.
Okay.
And you will find a lot of the information in this document. Hopefully we got the handouts in here. There is a diagram in here, and this diagram actually is the layout for what we're proposing. This came about, we were already on the pathway of completing a master plan with the city of San Jose. So we partnered with the city of San Jose to do a master plan on expanding the recycled and the purification system. That concluded in December. That report was completed. With the drought continuing, we're now looking to not only do it, but accelerate it.
I just wanted to get the numbers together in my head there.
Sure. So how can the commission help? Of course, allocation of Prop 1 funding. That is something that's very important to us. It helps bring on the burden when we go out for rate cases, and the community has actually been pretty receptive to rate increases. Our board has been very diligent about making sure we're holding rates down as much as possible. This last year, the rate increase was primarily due to acquiring water. It was due to the rebate program and the turf replacement, as well as outreach. Little, but some, was due to the loss of revenue, but the main drivers was the acquisition of water. So when we were able to go out to the community and say we've actually got some outside funding, whether it's state or federal funding, that helps them to understand they're not feeling the burden. So it really helps quite a bit. It can also help in supporting the appropriations. We go back to D.C., we're looking for federal appropriations, and that is also where we can use some of the commission's help. Questions?
Commissioner Daniels?
There should be a red light around the bar, around the microphone, if it's on.
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, just move, put the mic close.
How's that? Hello? Okay. Thank you for your presentation. I was a public works commissioner in Los Angeles for 6 years and worked a lot on the very same issues that you presented here, stormwater capture, recycle water, groundwater replenishment, all of that. So I have probably about a dozen questions, but I'm going to reduce it to three categories, if that's all right with the permission of the chair. I just wanted to follow up. I'll tell you the areas that I wanted to ask you about. One was your gray water program. The other, quick question on your purification system, and then I want to ask you about your groundwater storage project. And that's probably the most significant of the three questions. The other two are out of curiosity, but for the purposes of this commission, groundwater storage is what I want to learn more about. But just quickly on your gray water, something that I've been working on actually over the last year. Do you have a plan to increase gray water use in commercial buildings? Or is this program primarily directed to single-family residences?
The program currently is focused with single-family residents. A lot of the programs really are working at the city level, who actually have the building codes that they need to follow up on. We provide the funding for that. I do not have the answers whether we're moving on industrial gray water usage. We do have a program where with the businesses, the industry, where we actually contribute $50,000 of funding so them to do conservation programs. And that could include gray water.
There was a group that I, in along those lines, that I spoke with called Sustainable Silicon Valley, mm-hmm. and that you've probably heard of them. They might have even met here. I'm not sure. I spoke by Skype. But they were looking at trying to encourage that. And from the research I've done, one of the possibilities for gray water is also for indoor reuse, for toilet, for restroom flushing, which is about 30% of commercial building use. Just something to talk about. And if you're interested in that, I want to talk with you about it more.
So you are correct. We did have Sustainable Silicon Valley here about a month ago. You were right there on that screen.
That's
I saw
right.
you.
Yes.
But I also presented this past Friday to Sustainable Silicon Valley, as well as the regional director from San Francisco, Bruce Wolf. So we presented similar to the program we have here. One of the things that was focused on was on-site treatment systems. And on-site treatment systems are really going to help the water demand component as well as the wastewater component.
Right.
So as I mentioned, we had this summit with the cities. There is a meeting there's a meeting tomorrow where we're pulling a task force together of cities to talk about on-site treatment systems, which is actually what Sustainable Silicon Valley is promoting.
Paula from San Francisco's
convening.
Yes, great. I'd like to follow up with you on that separately because I think that's a really key part of our conservation strategy moving forward, particularly in commercial buildings where a lot of the use is demand is. Super fast on the water treatment. I notice you're moving toward indirect potable and direct potable reuse. Wondering what you think the timeline might be on direct.
Well, we are aiming for direct potable, but until the regulations provide for that, we're going to be doing indirect. The beauty of our system that we have, that was built not by me, by those who were here many years before us, is that when we bring that the purified water from our facility and we bring it up to our recharge ponds, we cross right over one of our raw water lines that goes to our treatment plants for drinking water, which is the South Bay Aqueduct water and the federal water. All we have to do is construct a flange, and when that water becomes available, we'll just connect the flange. Mm-hmm. So it'll be very inexpensive.
You're all set. And I imagine you're doing a lot of rainwater harvesting as well?
We haven't been, rainwater, we've been talking about it, we don't have a lot. Individual cities are undertaking some rainwater programs. I know my board has asked me what's our rainwater program. I say we got 10 reservoirs that capture as much rainwater as possible. But there are some issues that need to be addressed with rainwater, not only the use of it on site, but a lot of that water goes to our stream systems. If we're capturing everything from our stream systems, our streams won't be streams.
Well, part of why I ask is that one of the things I did for the city of L.A. was move a low-impact development ordinance through and got it adopted and part of what, since you have a groundwater basin, the value of having on-site stormwater capture and potential for recharge of your groundwater basin. So would just be interested to see how that works, and that segues into my next question about what your groundwater projects are that you hope could be eligible for Prop 1 funding.
So Let me address the stormwater capture. So one of the ways I think stormwater capture is going to be very valuable is our on-site systems. So as we're working to see if the cities can come up with a consistent ordinance and building codes and approach for on-site systems that can promote, that will help take care of future demands. Regarding our groundwater program, I would put our indirect potable system in that groundwater category because it is there to help recharge that groundwater basin to maintain it so we don't result in subsidence. We also have a number of reservoirs. We are doing a study of all of our reservoirs, going through seismic evaluations of all of our reservoirs. A couple of them need some work. Our largest, which is Anderson, is going to cost approximately $180 million for that particular facility. It is, we are actually looking at the latest seismic engineering and the latest technology to bring these reservoirs up, or the dams up to the seismic standards. There will be a substantial amount of funding that will be necessary to do that. That water that's captured here is really used for our recharge program. Mm-hmm.
So I imagine you're familiar with our what our requirements are in terms of funding, that our program funds the public benefits portion and 50% of that is ecosystem restoration, all of that. Have you been participating in the scoping surveys and the technical workshops?
Yes, we have been participating not only at the district staff level, but with other public agencies also.
Okay, thank you.
I had a question. Are you aiming to apply for funds for both Chapter 8 and other chapters in Prop 1?
We are looking for a number of opportunities to get funding from Prop 1. Some of those are for habitat restoration type of work, a lot of for groundwater, a lot of for infrastructure, recycled water, water conservation programs that we have put in place. We have a number of programs that we think will be very valuable for, you know, the public. I think they'll compete very well, and we'll be looking for support on that.
Yeah, very fascinating district here, kind of a combination of urban and rural, very diverse, very interesting presentation. Any other comments, questions? Commissioner Quintero?
Could you talk a little bit about your thinking about the future of your watershed management plans? Are you doing any innovation around that arena or in that arena?
So our water district encompasses the entire county.
Right.
Basically, it's watersheds. Lucky that it has been created that way. We provide flood protection, water supply, and environmental stewardship for healthy ecosystems. What we have embarked upon in this last year is a master plan, a water resources master plan for the entire county. And what we're looking to do is actually integrate not just my water supply side of the house and my flood protection side of the house, trying to integrate those. So we'll have multiple objective projects. So when we start doing projects, we'll be able to do, in fact, we have one, a flood protection project that is underway over in our Permanente watershed. And the fact what we have, the way it's been designed is upstream detention and then the downstream, we're actually able to remove concrete. So there's a segment down there, about a half a mile of concrete that will be able to be removed. This master plan is going to identify more of those opportunities. And the master plan is going to lay out more than we can fund. I got that. The master plan is going to allow this opportunities for some of our investor-owned and private entities that we have to actually pick up some of those projects. The one I just mentioned, we have one a major large company that is actually willing to fund the removal of the concrete and the design and construction, which is about $12 million. We created the opportunity, laid out the plan, and they were able to leverage from that. That master plan is intended to do more of that and set that phase. Our community has been very, generous. We have put a parcel tax back in 2000 that funded a lot of these environmental projects, a lot of the flood protection work. That was set to expire. We went out in 2012. With the new program, the next 15-year program, and it passed in Santa Clara County by 74%. This master plan will set it up so that in the future we can identify what projects would be fundable, would the community be interested in us providing, and lay those out for hopefully a safe, clean water measure that will come out in about another 10 years.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I'm interested in is in seeing how folks are looking upstream in terms of improving the health of literally the forests and the sponges that capture and maximize the capture of the rainfall. And there are a couple places in California where folks are doing some experimentation around that, mostly in the Sierra, but it's starting to happen in the Coast Range as well. So I'd encourage looking at those forests and how you might treat those going forward.
We are working with the open space districts around here. We have a number of open space. We partner with them. There's actually a master plan that they have mapped out that we're going to integrate. And that gets to, I think, your point of healthy upstream watersheds provides good water quality and healthy habitat and ecosystem for the community.
The question that Commissioner Quintero asked is one of my favorite topics as well, but what I find fascinating is that your structure allows for you to take a completely holistic approach from rain landing in the hillsides and the mountains and getting it into the groundwater and all the processes in between. And the idea of trying to consolidate agencies and stuff that are looking at all of these issues independently actually is in practice here, so that flood control is not simply flood control, it's actually recharge maximization and that sort of thing. So it's really heartening to hear the program. And we're going to do our best, I think, as a commission to encourage project development that really mirrors this kind of approach. It's a little complicated because we really can't combine projects in that way because of EIR and that sort of problem, but if we can combine the thinking so that people are looking at their projects in a way that maximizes every drop, that's what our objective is. So this is a great presentation. I did have one question on your program. When do you think, and I know there's a timeline in here somewhere that indicated that if you didn't get relief or at least expedited CEQA and regulatory reform, you'd have a certain set of timelines. Do you think there's any potential for that sort of regulatory and CEQA relief? Is there a sort of a organized effort by the water agencies to approach this statewide?
Well, regarding the CEQA, it's actually not only CEQA, but it's permits too.
Right.
It can take time. We're looking for ways to actually streamline that as quickly as possible. And I do want to be clear. It is not the intention of the organization to not do opportunities for the public to provide input. CEQA provides that. That is something that's important to, I know, to my board, to make sure we have that. So our efforts are to do it as quickly as possible. We are also looking at public-private partnerships. Next Tuesday, the 22nd, we're having a special work study session with the board on public-private partnerships and how can they work and can they expedite, can they shift risk for some of these programs. So that's the effort that we have going on right now. We have not done that. We're evaluating, looking at what other agencies have done. Some of those, as you're probably familiar, San Diego Water Authority,
right,
have done that. So we're looking at their program. It takes time, but when we get this, let me just be clear, our objective is to get that purification system constructed as quickly as possible, because
right,
I do not know how long this drought is going to last, and we need to get that drought-proof supply as quickly as possible, and we want to leverage the community's interest and support right now.
So I would think personally, and perhaps as a commission, we'd be really interested in, to know how your efforts in that, I don't want to call it regulatory relief, let's call it expediting regulatory efforts, either consolidating them so that hearings can be multiple purpose. I don't know. It would
right,
be very interesting to see how that goes. And I think public-private partnerships are an important potential, if not for just leveraging for finances, but I think you risk transfer is pretty critical. So it's great. Oops.
Okay. Any further questions or discussion? Yes, Commissioner Quintero.
You mentioned AMI, and you mentioned an area where you're funding the implementation of that. Is that happening in any other areas within Santa Clara Valley Water District?
So right now what we have is these innovative approaches that we're trying to seed money to test if these are going to work. if those are successful and we do get the result that we're looking for, then I can anticipate that more funding would be provided. We'd be promoting those kinds of techniques.
Yeah, I mean, I just got to believe that as more of us have a dashboard that gives us an immediate read on what our behavior is doing, we're going to see change. And I think until we get there, it's going to be slow. I think that's really where we need to head personally. Right? So I'm glad you're doing that.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. No further questions. Thank you. That was a very interesting. Do you have some more comments?
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you for listening, for one. But I also wanted to emphasize that none of this would have been possible for this agency if it really wasn't the leadership that comes from those who sit in the seats when you're not here. It's really the board that back in the 20s when they were thinking about this to the point where we are today in handling this drought, they have been very aggressive and proactive in making sure we are connecting with the community and we're getting that community to conserve water. I will tell you this, the results that we got for May were... And I have to throw this out because they're very impressive. And the board's going to hear this in a minute. I'll give you the right numbers. Our conservation results for May were 25% conservation. And the one that we had that's coming out now is, I think, is 28%. So we've had communities that are actually achieving 38% in some of our areas. So it's been very responsive. So thank you again.
Okay, thank you. We have a couple of things that we kind of took a little bit out of order, so we're going to go back to item 5, and we want to have an opportunity here for commissioners to present any conversations or meetings that you may have had with the public. Is there anyone that would like to present anything? Okay. Commissioner Ball?
I had the meeting at the water purification plant.
All right, and then I think at this time we also want to open up for any public testimony. There have been speaker cards available. Is there anyone that is going to want to do any public comments? Okay, very well then. Looks like we will be going to item 8. Update on implementation of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Steven Springhorn. I work for the Department of Water Resources, and I'm on the Sustainable Groundwater Management Implementation Team. And today I'd like to discuss three topics. We last spoke on the groundwater basin boundary revision regulations in April. I'd like to give an update on that, those regulations. I'd like to introduce the groundwater sustainability plan and alternative regulations and the process we plan to go through for those, and then give a quick informational update on the status of groundwater sustainability agencies that is occurring throughout the state. And the importance of the first two, I'll go to this next slide. The importance of the first two regulations is these regulations will require the Commission's approval and adoption of these regulations. And that's why we want to work closely with the Commission and give frequent updates on our progress of these regulations. And then, and how the where these regulations fit on the roadmap of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, or SGMA. This is the roadmap here. It's hard to see. It's in the presentation materials and available on the website there. But the basin boundary regulations are right up front, and we're working hard to get that done. So that provides the boundaries or revisions to the existing boundaries for groundwater sustainability agencies to start to form and develop their groundwater sustainability plans. The GSP, or the Groundwater Sustainability Plan regulations, are critical. These are the critical element of SGMA. This is the planning. This sets the minimum standard or the standard for statewide sustainability moving forward. And then the GSAs, the deadline for GSA formation is June 30th, 2017, just to put things into context. So now getting into the update on the groundwater basin boundary revision regulations. So the current groundwater basins and subbasins that are defined in DWR Bulletin 118, And they've been defined using the best available information at the time. And historically, revisions to these boundaries have been during each update to Bulletin 118 under an existing water code authority the department has. So the figures on the bottom of the screen here just show that previous versions of Bulletin 118, there's been four bulletins, and the current bulletin was last updated in 2003. And the figure there of the state in the blue are the 515 groundwater basins that are currently defined and that make up about 40% of this state area. And I should note that the boundaries, the basins themselves, have been defined through time using the best available information, but there still is a lot of information out there that needs to be collected and to better define them through time. So it's not a perfect data set. It's an imperfect data set, and the regulations will need to reflect that variability. So just really quickly, some key definitions related to these regulations. And the definition of a basin is the critical one. And it is, you could think of this in simplistic terms as the bathtub of aquifer material, sands, gravels, semi-consolidated sediments that groundwater moves freely through. And the basin boundaries are the external boundaries are sort of the limits of where this aquifer is. So on the other side of that boundary is sort of non-aquifer material, and within the basin is aquifer material. So that's an external boundary. That will be important. So then a sub-basin is a subdivision of the larger basins into smaller groundwater basins, into smaller units using geologic or hydrologic barriers or institutional boundaries. And so the basin boundaries, the external extent of the aquifer, has really always been defined by scientific information, geologic maps, technical studies, whereas the internal sub-basin lines have been defined historically with hydrogeologic information as well as governance and management of the groundwater resource. And another key point is that within this graphic, it shows the red lines in the lower graphic represent sub-basin or internal lines, and they can be on rivers or creeks or faults or political boundaries like county lines or water agency lines, and they're currently defined that way. And their groundwater flows freely through most of these internal basin lines, so that requires coordination moving forward through the SGMA implementation. So just a local example, really quick, going from a graphic form to actually on the ground where we are today, we are in the Santa Clara sub-basin, which is a smaller portion of the larger Santa Clara Valley basin. So just to give you an idea of what these existing basins look like, the external boundaries of the basin we are in today are the Santa Cruz Mountains on the west and then the Diablo Range on the east. And then the internal boundaries, sub-basin boundaries, are on county lines from Santa Clara County to San Mateo and then to Alameda County. So just to give a local example. So the requirements of this process in SGMA are that the department has to create emergency regulations, so it's a fast-tracked approach to regulations. It's not the regular rulemaking process. For local agencies to request revisions to these existing boundaries, and we need to accomplish that by January 1st, 2016. And there's a list of instructions to local agencies of what they need to submit, and our regulations will be keying off these four categories of information. It's information demonstrating sustainability, technical information on the boundaries and conditions in the basins, consultation with interested parties in the affected basins, and then other information DWR deems necessary. So the department has to take that information and in the regulation set up the methodology and criteria of how to assess it for the likelihood that these new basins will be subject to sustainable management and that these changes will not limit sustainable management in the adjacent basins, and whether there's a history of sustainable groundwater management of groundwater levels in the proposed basin. So you've seen this figure before, and this is how we plan to approach these regulations and how we've been moving through them, and it's a phased approach. We started with initial scoping, gathering issues and challenges with the existing basins from stakeholders and the public. We use that to define or develop a draft framework for these regulations, where we went out and had public listening sessions on this framework. It was very valuable to do that. We got a lot of good feedback, and we are using that feedback as we're moving forward and drafting the emergency regulations, which will then have another series of public meetings that are required in statute to get additional feedback on these emergency regulations, and then we'll move into the final step of adoption, which requires the commission's approval, and then we'll submit the regulation to the Office of Administrative Law.
Go ahead. I have a question.
Yeah.
Are you seeing any innovation around instrumentation and measurement of groundwater basins as folks are talking to each other about how to set up these boundaries or their input on the boundaries?
Yeah, and data will be a key element in not only basin boundary revisions or to justify them, but moving forward with the GSPs, and that's really where you're going to have the data to plan.
Right.
And innovation in monitoring methodology, is that your question?
Yes.
Yeah, there are a lot of new techniques of data loggers and telemetry, you know, and just, I guess, trying to collect as many different monitoring sources into sort of an integrated approach, so you know what the difference, you know, you're linking surface water with groundwater.
Well, and it seems like, yeah, a couple of gaps are things like understanding where the water is moving by doing things like tracing isotopes, so you can,
yeah,
tell what the fingerprint is of the water in terms of its origin and the path that it's taking to where it's being drawn out of the ground, as well as what's happening with water quality in these aquifers, because my understanding is that as you draw them down and then recharge them, there's changes in the water quality and chemistry that are pretty critical. And so I think we're delving into a world where we're going to need real-time information for everybody, the users, the managers, and the agencies involved with this.
Yeah, that's a key point, and that really, the boundary regulations touch on that, because we feel that for any major changes, that there needs to be technical justification to make those changes, so we know that these basins or adjacent basins will not be affected by the change, but also that is critical to the GSPs and having that data set to make informed decisions off of. So that's really the context for that. Thank you. I was going to mention that throughout this process, we have been coordinating with the State Water Resources Control Board, who are our partners in this implementation of SGMA. So really quickly, what that process looks like on a timeline, the orange boxes are engagements of the commission. We last spoke in Fresno in April. We then had our public listening sessions just after that. Our next planned meeting is in July, where we plan to come before the commission and present the proposed draft regulations for the basin boundary revision process. We'll then have our required public meetings on those draft regulations, and then we plan to incorporate public comment into draft final regulations in the October timeframe, hoping to potentially get board approval in October or in November, so we can submit that approved regulation to the Office of Administrative Law. So just really quickly, the summary of basin boundary outreach, and we touched on this, and I'll just go quickly through this. We received great input from the initial scoping. We developed that draft framework document that we went out with on public listening sessions to get input on, and all of that outreach has really helped us better understand specific stakeholder perspectives on these regulations. So it's been critical to us moving forward. And what we presented was the sort of the goal of these regulations, which stems from the new state policy of groundwater, which is statewide sustainable groundwater management. And so our goal for these regulations, and you'll see this reflected in the regulation, is that groundwater resources are sustainably managed within existing Bulletin 118 basins unless there's compelling reasons that are supported by adequate technical information and broad agreement, which includes coordination, that these new basins will increase the likelihood of sustainability and will not affect adjacent basins. So the summary of what we've heard from our outreach is broken into these key elements. We heard loud and clear that local flexibility will be critical for boundary revisions and also GSPs, but as it relates to boundary revisions, that there's going to have to be a lot of decisions and tough decisions on the local level to form these GSAs, groundwater sustainability agencies, and move forward with groundwater sustainability plans. So we heard that. We also heard that there's broad acknowledgement that coordination is critical for all of this, the boundary revision type of questions. Size of the basin and sub-basin, we've heard both sides on this one. This was a hot topic where groups want to think big and increase basin sizes or to potentially incorporate more tools and work with more local agencies. On the other side, we heard perspectives that maybe going smaller or existing, framing basins around existing management structures that are working. So we've heard both perspectives on that. As the same with scientific and governance justification, well, where we've heard perspectives that all basin boundary changes should be based on scientific information, and then a different perspective where more the governance and managerial aspects of groundwater management should be acknowledged too. And then finally, there was broad agreement that existing boundaries, they have not been updated since 2003, so there are a lot of geologic maps and technical studies to make quite a few minor changes to update them to the best available information. So how we're taking that input and the feedback and rolling that into the crafting of the regulation is that, again, I mentioned we feel as a department that we're going to move forward with the existing boundaries as they are and encourage local agencies to form GSAs in those boundaries. But we acknowledge that there might need to be some revisions. And we agree local flexibility is critical, but that comes with adequate justification. You have to have local flexibility, but at the local level, you need to have broad agreement for the revisions and coordination of the revisions, and then technical justification to back up those revisions. And then talking about the types of boundary revisions, this gets at the variability of the types that might come to us of changes or revisions, where there could be a lot of minor changes, so snapping lines based on new information, just small changes, or in major changes where you're combining basins or maybe they're creating new sub-basins. And so we're thinking of having a tiered approach, and potentially the minor changes, if they're agreed upon, have adequate technical information, they could be streamlined through process, and then maybe more requirements for the major changes to boundaries. And that gets at the same thing with basin, sub-basin boundary revisions. I mentioned earlier, the boundaries of the basin are the external extent of the aquifer and have been always based in scientific information to justify those or define those. Whereas sub-basin boundaries have had more of that flexibility historically as they've been defined with scientific and groundwater management justification. And then that really gets into the adequate size of the basin for sustainable management and making sure that whatever basin comes out at the end of these revisions is adequately sized for sustainable management. And then finally, timing, how this fits into the overall implementation of the other components of SGMA. And that's sort of after the regs are adopted. And we have a series of requirements that the department has to abide by each time a boundary is revised. We have to evaluate and approve these revisions through this new regulation. The commission has to hear and comment on any boundary revision. So that's a new requirement that came through SGMA. So that's a new step that we'll be bringing basin boundary revisions to the commission, the ones that we have draft approved in a batch to you to hear and comment on those. And then each time a boundary is changed, the basin prioritization has to reoccur. So that's the high and medium basins that are subject to SGMA. There could be some changes in priority moving forward or initiated by basin changes. And then finally, all of the new basin boundaries have to be published in Bulletin 118. And the next update to that is an interim update in 2017. So for the reasons I just described, so the initial window for basin boundary requests will be a short window because of the tight timeline and our subsequent activities we have to do. It's going to be a 3-month window is what we're targeting for local agencies to submit boundary revision requests. Local agencies will know in July and August what the draft regulations will be, so there'll be a time for them to understand the regulations and see if they need or want to make a change. And then we're planning to update or link the future revision request windows with updates to Bulletin 118, which they're updated. That bulletin is updated in 0 and 5, years ending in 0 and 5. So now getting at the GSP and alternative regulations. This is really where all the group, all the players come together, and there's different roles for DWR with creating the regulations and providing technical and financial assistance. The state board is there to enforce, and the GSAs and local agencies are there to plan and implement their plans. So this is really the critical element of SGMA, and these GSPs will set the standard for sustainable groundwater management in the state. We plan to use a similar approach to the basin boundaries with a phased approach where we're in the initial scoping phase of those regulations. The difference with the GSP regulations is that they're a much bigger topic, more complex, more issues and challenges, and just more components. And that's why the draft framework, we're going to break that up into topics or batches of topics, and I'll show a figure of that in two slides, to get input, detailed input, on those individual key topics. And then that will help us make informed decisions on the regulations. Then we'll go through the draft. We'll develop draft emergency regulations for the GSPs, have our required public meetings, and then go through the same adoption process through the commission. What that looks like on a timeline, this is a busy slide, but I think it's important to show the integration of the boundary regs with the GSP regulations, so we're moving on these concurrently. And the GSP schedule is below the timeline. So this summer, we plan to come to before the commission to give periodic updates and on the GSP regulations. We plan to have the GSP draft regulations out in the late winter timeframe, hold our required public meetings, and then adopt the GSP regulations in the spring of 2016. And so here are the different topics. This is another busy slide, but this really shows the complexity of what these GSPs have to cover, the different elements. And so we're planning a phased approach to outreach. So we want to go in front of, get input from our advisory groups and the public on all these elements. So we're planning to batch them. So the first batch of those red circles, we'll be talking in the late June, July timeframe with our advisory groups and the public. And then we'll subsequently go through the second and third batches throughout the summer to get informed input on each one of these critical elements of the GSPs, so we can use that as we're creating the regulations. So finally, just a real quick update on an information update on the GSA activity that's occurring, and just a quote from Governor Brown where local groundwater management in California is best achieved locally, and these GSAs is really where the action is happening right now on the ground. Local agencies are talking to each other and trying to form these management agencies that will have to be developing the groundwater sustainability plans. So the department posts all of the GSA notifications we receive on our website within 15 days. That's a requirement. We have this website that has a searchable table of all the GSA information we have received. So, and all of the information that's justifying the GSAs, as well as we plan to have an interactive map so everyone, the public and interested parties, can see where these GSAs, the boundaries of these GSAs, are forming throughout the state. And so we should be seeing this map fill out over time before the June 30th deadline. And so currently we have 11 GSA notifications that have come in. These are in 13 basins or sub-basins in 5 counties, so it's the blue areas in the map there. Those are the basins highlighted, so the GSAs are forming in those basins right now. And the department wants to facilitate the formation of GSAs, and how we're doing that is we're offering facilitation support services to aid local agencies with GSA formation. This is general fund money. This is outside of the Prop 1 funding. The applications will be evaluated on a continuous basis, and levels of the support will vary based on need. And so the services offered are we'll be providing, there's contracts in place already, we'll be providing professional facilitators to go in and work with local agencies to identify stakeholders and do stakeholder assessments, help with meeting facilitation and public outreach, and then governance assessments and mediation. And as I mentioned, this is happening now, so for more information, if local agencies are interested, we have a website dedicated to this where you can get a lot more information and contact information to the regional coordinators that are working with local agencies to get these funds or these services out and help these GSAs form in the state. So with that, I'd just like to thank you for your attention, and I look forward to working with the commission through these regulations. And if there are any questions or any, if you want any additional detailed information on any part of this, just let me know. And just these links here are relevant or helpful resources, internet resources for local agencies. And then any comments or questions that aren't answered today can be emailed in. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Stephen. Great presentation. I would like to have Director Orth some questions.
Okay. Just a couple of comments and some questions. First of all, well done. I think there's a tremendous amount of work here that I continue to advocate bringing to the Commission regularly so that we understand what's going on in the field. And I think one thing that you probably under-reported was just the amount of effort that you have in dealing with the local agencies and the stakeholders in various venues to get a lot of input. There's a tremendous amount of activity going on, and DWR is doing a great job supporting that. I guess I have three questions. One is, and I think, Stephen, you spoke to this, relative to the boundaries. I've been hearing at the local level that the Bulletin 118 boundaries don't necessarily align with the boundaries of the alluvium as we've developed more information. And in fact, I think there are a lot of agencies that are starting to initiate some studies. I'm not sure how you see that. Are those technical corrections that get made, or are those actual studies that will have to come back to the Commission as part of the Commission's role in approving boundary adjustments? Where do you see the alluvium boundary issue weighing in on this?
Yeah, and that's a great point. And there, as I mentioned, the boundaries haven't been updated since 2003, so there are a lot of these types of changes you've described. And we plan to have a place for these in the regulations where you're updating the boundary based on new information, updated information. And that this has always been done through the history of Bulletin 118 and the definition of basins. So that would come through the regulation process. And so there'd be a certain category of for that type of change with certain requirements. So if there's that technical justification for expanding or rearranging the line based on new information of where that extent of alluvium is, we definitely support that. And then that would come to the Commission once it goes through the process and is a draft-approved boundary revision. It would come in front of the Commission and then ultimately end up in the future Bulletin 118.
That's a good segue to the second question I have relative to timing, and I know we've talked about this a little bit. I'm not sure that the three-month window in early 2016 and then a subsequent second window 3 years later fits real well with the timing of doing these alluvium studies along with a lot of the other work that's going to be done at the GSA level. And I think it's important to recognize that GSAs are going to be working hard to try to figure out how they organize, how they structure their governance, and how they initiate their planning processes to meet the first deadline of June 30th of 2017. Thank you for bringing this slide up. And I fear that a lot of us, a lot of them, myself included, won't be prepared in that first three-month window. And to wait an additional 3 years for the second window is going to be a bit cumbersome. Now, the only solution I have to that today is recognizing the Bulletin 118 update and the water plan update and the prioritization processes that all have to take place between window one and window two is thinking about keeping window one open just a little bit longer. And I know we've talked about that, but I want to continue to offer that.
Okay.
And then the third thing, if you would back up to slide 15. I know you talked about basin boundaries being adjustable based on technical information, scientific information, or governance. And I wonder if in this draft regulatory approach where you talk about technical information, are you necessarily restricting to just scientific-based adjustments, or is there still an opportunity to make boundary adjustments based on governance? And I think given the county's default role in areas where local agencies either don't exist or choose not to become a GSA, there can, I think, be good justification going forward for a governance-based adjustment of a management area as opposed to just a pure scientific study of how the alluvium falls and where the groundwater moves. So I'm interested in where the department is headed on that particular issue.
Yeah, that's a great question. I failed to get into the details on that. And we've been messaging all along that technical information is both scientific information as well as the governance or management information as well. And this gets at tried to make the point that the external boundaries of the basin boundaries of where from the aquifer to non-aquifer, those have always been defined by scientific information because it's the extent of the aquifer system. However, the internal boundaries, the sub-basin boundaries, those have always been flexible in previous Bulletin 118s. And that's where that balance between scientific and management or governance justification or technical information comes into play, because we feel that there needs to be scientific information, but also if there's a good justification, as you mentioned, Commissioner Orth, for counties to be involved, and if that helps streamline or increase the likelihood of sustainable management in those basins moving forward with their GSPs, it's something we feel we will be supporting. So it's that balance, and that really takes place in the internal rearrangement of lines, so within the overall basin itself. Hopefully that clarifies that. Okay, thank you.
So just a real quick question on that. Updates on boundaries, what kind of things are updated on boundaries, governance type things?
Updates on boundaries.
You said there hadn't been any updates since 2003 on basin boundaries.
That's correct. So you could think of the basin boundaries as two components. One is the GIS, or the line on the map, and the written description. So the written description is in Bulletin 118 now, and it describes what the boundaries of these basins are. But then the more visual, or what we all see, is what the lines on the map. Taking that written description and transforming it to the map. So that's what I mentioned. The written descriptions and accompanying GIS lines or lines on the map have not been updated since 2003. And so a lot of those lines and written descriptions are based on older information. So that's where these new geologic maps or technical studies could be used to update that written description and then update the accompanying line on the map. Those are the types of changes I was referring to.
I see. Thank you. Okay. Commissioner Daniels.
Thank you. Actually, Commissioner Orth asked the question I was going to ask. I had the same question about how you're reconciling the request on basin boundary adjustment based on technical or governance information.
Oh, okay.
So you did address that. But just maybe two quick follow-ons to that. And if it's too complicated to address it now, I could talk to you about it separately. But I'm wondering if you have an example where that has played out most significantly, that question about technical and governance boundaries, where it seems to be more crucial for a particular groundwater basin one than the other. Do you have an example of that? And then the other question I have is, let me let you answer that one first.
Okay, yeah, let me get back to one of these slides here. It's hard to see, but in the Central Valley, you can see essentially the Central Valley is one basin, one groundwater basin. And all those internal lines there are all the sub-basins that are defined. And you can see some of are very straight. They're along county lines, and some are along rivers. So that balance between...
So basically the whole Central Valley.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, there are many examples. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, that and how it gives me a sense of the scale of the problem.
Okay, and then just moving forward.
It'd be further informative if you put the county lines on this map, because you could then see how the county lines don't track with the sub-basin lines.
Yeah.
Yes.
Where there's going to be discussion about which line best manages.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a larger issue than just two or three.
It's a big issue.
It is, and we have a tool that is helpful on this issue. It's a water management planning tool. It's an interactive map where you can put all sorts of different layers on there on an interactive map, and you can see the overlap of county lines. And and I'll email you a link. I can show you where that is.
That would be
and,
great.
And walk
that'll,
you through
that'll
that.
That'll help me. I need to catch up a little bit.
Okay, great.
So I think some of the other catching up I need to do, and I imagine other people know this, but they're the advisory groups for these plants that you are, that's separate from the stakeholder advisory committee for the water storage program, obviously, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And there's a list of those somewhere?
Yeah, there's a list of those on our website, our sustainable groundwater management website. I can get to that as we're getting
that's
there.
That's okay. I'll find it.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay. Any others?
Just a quick comment. It seems like you might want to replace versus with and.
Yes,
you know, because
point.
I think it sets up a conflict that doesn't really exist. It's in all cases, it's going to be a match of the two working together.
That's what
it did to my brain.
That's a very good point. It's not an either or. It's a combination.
Yeah,
of both.
It's yeah.
Yep. Very good point.
Thanks.
Any other questions or comments?
Yes.
I'd like to ask one if I could. You said that you're going to bring the proposed draft regulations back to the commission in July. Are you expecting action from the commission at that time or just input? What sort of expectations do you have for that?
That's a great clarification. So it's more of an information, and we're not expecting action at that point. It's just to inform the commission that this is the direction we're headed with these emergency regulations, and we'd like to get feedback from the commission on these regulations. And so it's more informational. And then as it relates to board action, the October-November timeframe, that's what we're talking about for board action of adoption of the emergency regulations.
Yes, sir. Mr. Quintero.
You know, I would like to see if the board could get, or the commission could be notified when you're having these listening sessions for boundary changes, because it sounds like you're doing them all over the state, and I think it would be really valuable for us to be able to participate. And I know some of us have gone to those sessions, but I'd like to attend
or
two of those.
We will definitely do that. So the next round will be the public meetings once the draft regulations are posted, and so that will be in the... We have those scheduled for the first week of September right now, and we'll have that. We'll send that information to the commission. And what we plan to do is we're required to have a meeting in Northern California, the Central Valley, and Southern California. And the first meeting we're going to have, it's going to be recorded or broadcast and recorded. So for all those who cannot attend in person, they'll be able to get the same information that if you were in the room. We'll be taking questions from the internet audience, essentially.
Yeah. Commissioner Orr.
Our executive officer's question sparked something that I guess I should know, but I don't. If you present draft regulations to the commission in July and you want our input, and then I can see on the calendar or the proposed timeline on page 11 that there's a subsequent public comment period, is that a public comment period process that the commission will conduct, or is that a public comment period that the department conducts and then brings back to the commission when we have the finals to review? I'm not clear on that.
Yeah, that's a good distinction. So that's The way it's written in statute in SGMA is that the department is required to go out and hold these public meetings. And so we will do that as a department, and then we will report back, or if you're attending, you'll be invited to those, and then we'll report back the feedback we've received from those public meetings.
Commissioner Daniels.
Thank you. And I'm just wondering about the report back, the information. You've done a great job of summarizing what you have so far, but I would be interested in seeing a little bit more specificity in the comments, if possible. Sort of a table of some yep. type, which I can talk to you about, unless other commissioners have different ideas. I don't want to... I'm sure you're summarizing it in that fashion anyway.
Yeah, and our goal, and as we move into the formal rulemaking process, where we post the draft or proposed draft emergency regulations, that initiates this comment period, and we will be tracking every comment we receive, and the comments have to come in written form. And we'll be posting those on our website as we receive them. So there'll be our archive of all the comments we get.
But I was looking for some sort of synthesis.
Yes. And so what we can do is we can take all of those contents and we can we'll synthesize that down into the key elements.
Yeah.
That we've heard.
And which, you know, which speaker or commenter, et cetera. So it's attributable.
Yeah, that's we can do that.
Thank you.
No further questions or discussion? Then thank you, Stephen.
Okay, thank you very much.
And so now we'll go to item nine, which would be the overview of update on program administrative activities for Water Storage Investment Program. Tracy.
Okay, thank you, and it's my pleasure to be back up in front of everyone. I'm covering for Jenny Marr today, and this can be a very short presentation, which is succinctly summarized in there's lots of activities ongoing on all fronts. But I'll give it a little more detail. So for the regulations work group, we're continuing to work on the draft guidelines and doing more work on the review process and working on the priorities, and the agency teams are really focusing in on the draft priorities and relative environmental values and metrics, which will be presented to you next month. For the technical work groups, they're looking at how do you measure the physical changes, and this is basically the without project conditions, so you'll be there'll be a comparison between the with and without project. Definitions, and they're looking at the examples of which biological opinions would you have to be considering in your without project conditions, or how do you address climate change and sea level. And the groups that are working on this is an agency team of the Commission, DWR, Fish and Wildlife, the State Board, and also, and those are the main members. The economics work group, it's basically DWR, the Commission, and our consultant economists, and we're really looking on things like discount factors or what interest rates we'll be telling folks to use, the year of your cost projections, so all dollars for cost estimates need to be in 2015, 2016 dollars, setting up a set of rules on how to do your economic analysis. For the environmental and water quality work group, that is DWR, the Commission, Fish and Wildlife, the State Board, and the Delta Stewardship Council, and we're looking at the taking a look really at the potential metrics for the how do you measure your aquatic benefits, and these are all based off of the draft priorities that Fish and Wildlife has prepared, and they're continuing to work on what their priorities are, and it's basically the same for the State Board priorities for water quality and metrics that would be used for evaluating water quality improvements. And I promised it would be short. So, any questions?
That was very short, Tracy. I would like to ask you this, and I'm sure I'm probably going to ask you this repeatedly every month. Everything look like it's going on our timeline?
Yes, we are really trying to meet the timeline, and everybody's working quickly. there's some of us who just, you know, are nervous. There's so much going on and so much to do
that
we're hoping that it'll all come together, but it's progress is being made.
It's great to hear.
All right, thanks.
Any questions or comments? Very good. Thank you, Tracy. Paula?
Okay, I have a couple items. One is that Commissioner Curtin had asked to have a resolution or some process that would allow the commission to make a strong statement and document that statement, saying that the commission supports synergistic packaging of projects, that is, projects that would achieve greater benefit if they're brought together as opposed to individually. And we rolled around different ways to accomplish this and decided that a good solution would be to add a bullet to the program goals, objectives, and principles document. So in your binder under tab 9, there is a copy of page 7 of that goals, objectives, and principles document with the addition of the proposed bullet. And I will read it for you. Promote integration of projects that will provide large-scale public benefits that are greater than the sum of benefits of the individual projects. So what I would ask the commission to do is to direct staff to make this change to the program goals, objectives, and principles document and bring it back to the commission, the document in its entirety, in July for approval.
Any discussion on this? I think it seems to fit in pretty well.
Okay, great. Thank you. We will do that. The other item I have for you is the also under tab 9 in your binder is the topics for the issues working session. And you can see there are a couple of resolved issues, but I would like to direct you specifically to what's going to go on in July because we have a lot of items there on page 2 of that table. I think it starts at the bottom of page 1. Yeah. Options for independent technical review team, finalizing the goals, objectives, and principles documents, which I just mentioned, quantification of public benefits, applying priorities and relative values in the application review process, measurable improvements. How do we define measurable improvements to the Delta and the TRIPS? These are all very meaty topics. And these are specific to the water storage investment program, but as you just heard from our previous speaker, it's not the only thing we'll have on our plate in July, as we also have things like the SGMA program. We'll be looking at the draft regulations. So we have a two-day meeting in July. We are going to make every effort to get this material to you ahead of time because of a lot of stuff for you to digest. So hopefully when we are meeting then, we'll be prepared to move these items to the next step. Any questions?
Are we back in Sacramento in July?
Yes, every other month is in Sacramento, and every other month will be two-day sessions, as and this, the meetings outside of Sacramento will continue to be one day.
Okay. Commissioner Daniels.
Thank you. I know I've mentioned this before, so I'm sorry for repeating it, but I do see the amount of work that has to be done, and I say this with great appreciation and acknowledgement of how much is going on in every day in between the times that we meet at the staff level. But I still remain a little bit unclear as to how, when we look at these issue items, how they'll fit all together in context for our decision-making process. So I just want to repeat that again somehow, and I'm, you know, I know we could probably talk about this offline, how to organize the information so that the context is more clear. But I'm also saying it now at the microphone in case I'm alone in this. If it's more clear to other commissioners, then I don't want to just be making more work for you all by needing my own elucidation here. So I'll try to catch up if it's more clear to others.
If I could interject, and I'm new to this too, but I'm struggling with that as well. So I need to try and encapsulate it in my mind in a way that it's I don't know, maybe it's generational or something. But
no. No, I but think yeah. It's just complex.
Okay.
And yeah. I understand that you're trying to
but I agree.
Decision points we can actually make, but for me, deciding a definition for public benefits and eligible project types without seeing the whole context is going to be
Trying to think of another word besides issues, because issues is not really descriptive of what we're doing. These are processes. These are actions. They're something. I'm struggling for a word, but anyway, I get the concept and I agree with you, and we'll work on it.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
I'm just curious about the timing. So are we looking at the 14th and the 15th or the 15th and the 16th next month?
I believe it is 15, 16.
Okay. Thank you.
So that would be a Wednesday, Thursday.
Right.
Thursday. Okay. Anything further, Paula?
No, that's all I had.
Okay. We do have a speaker on this agenda item from the public. Yes, I'd like to recognize Tim from Restore the Delta.
Tim Strohshane from Restore the Delta. I'm a policy analyst with that organization. My topic goes to the topics you'll actually talk about next month or perhaps this afternoon in some earnest. But I have to leave soon, so I've been granted the opportunity to speak to you now about this. And that is whether tributaries to the Delta should include the Tulare Lake Basin. While historically the basin was frequently connected to the Delta through Fresno Slough, hydrological trends reflect the basin's efforts to keep as much water as possible. Whatever arrives there stays there, ideally. DWR's unimpaired flow report that runs between 2003 shows that Tulare Lake Basin drainage to the Delta occurs just 41 out of the 82 years in that record. So that's half the time. It's not insubstantial when you look at it that way, but that is flow that only 8 of those years has occurred in the last 20 years of that time period from between 1983 and 2003. The average Tulare Lake Basin discharge to the Delta is just 174,000 acre feet, according to that same report. So it's a very, very small amount. It is well under 1% of the average unimpaired flow that report chronicles by DWR. And so we would, and we feel that reflects the intense control over surface water. And again, I'm talking about unimpaired flow. So an unimpaired flow doesn't actually happen. It's what the actual flow is that counts here. With all due respect to Commissioner Orth and the Kings River Conservation District, the basin should not have it both ways, in our view. That is to say that the commission should not accede to the desire of water interests in the Tulare Lake Basin to be eligible for public benefits to the Delta, while at the same time they strive to prevent existing flows reaching the Delta using their existing facilities and resources. Since their recent record bears out their drive to sever tributary connection to the Delta, the basin should, for Prop 1 funding allocation purposes, not be considered tributary to the Delta and therefore ineligible for public benefits consideration. Thank you for considering our remarks.
Commissioner North.
I just want to clarify, you might stay up there just
My comments last month were consistent with what you just recommended. I'm not suggesting, or never did suggest, that the definition of tributary should include the Tulare Lake Basin watershed, or the Tulare Basin watershed. I felt that, in fact, for a lot of reasons that you've just stated, it should not be included and be eligible for consideration as a public, as a delta ecosystem public benefit, for all the reasons that you've said. So I want to be clear that I wasn't promoting the alternative. I'm actually promoting what you're suggesting. And I think there's a bigger question here that we may discuss later this afternoon, and that is what the intended investment of the public benefit portion of the funding was supposed to do relative to delta ecosystem improvement and the improvement of the state system. And I think an argument can be made that investments in the Kings or the Kern watershed don't have a direct benefit to the delta as much as making in delta investments. So I hope that's clear.
I appreciate hearing that. I was unaware of your specific remarks, so I appreciate you clarifying them for me. Yeah, I appreciate that. And I'll be sure to share that with folks at the Restore the Delta. Okay. Any other questions for me?
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Sure, thank you.
Okay, so we do have something on this. Paula will talk on this subject.
Okay, well, next on the agenda, I think the gentleman spoke now because he has to leave before our discussion of that this afternoon on the tributaries, so thank you for your input. Next up, we have an update on what has been going on with other meetings and communication and engagement for the commission work. There were a number of meetings conducted. There was a stakeholder advisor committee meeting earlier this month. In May, there was a public workshop. The scoping survey has been closed, and we'll give you the summary of that at our very busy July meeting. And also, there was a two-day tribal consultation in June, so I'll walk you through these a little bit. At the Stakeholder Advisory Committee meeting, we had a presentation by Debbie Davis-Franco from the Governor's Office of on human rights. What are the concern is, how is that going to play into what the Commission does? Obviously, we have to consider it. Representative, the attorney from the State Board, had done an analysis and concluded that the human right to water does not fit under the definition of public trust, but it is something that our project applicants will have to consider, as well as we will consider when we're putting together our guidelines. At the SAC meeting also, Department of Fish and Wildlife and the State Water Resources Control Board distributed their list of priorities which need to be considered when the Commission is reviewing and prioritizing ranking proposals. Their lists were not encompassing of everything that their agencies are responsible for. I'll bring that up because that became an issue later at the tribal consultation meeting. Some of the concerns from advisory committee members were that the lists themselves were not prioritized. But we kind of left it that would be something that the commission would want some discretion over. Both of those agencies are accepting written comments from stakeholder advisory committee members. Those comments are due on the 16th, I believe, so they should have them now. We'll get another read on the response to those lists of priorities. And again, the application review flowchart, which you had seen at your last commission meeting, was shared with the group, and there was some discussion of how that would be beneficial and to the applicants themselves, which is a different perspective, obviously, than the commission has. So at the public workshop, which was the first one that's been held, there were approximately 40 attendees. They were from all over the state, which in itself was a bit of a challenge because the workshop had been laid out so that people would self-identify with their geographic location and see if we could encourage them to look for packaging of projects and things specific to their area. And there were individuals, for example, from LA Basin that didn't have a group to align with, et cetera, but still some good information came out of those individual group sessions. And the team also presented the framework for quantifying public benefits. The tribal consultation meeting was, as I mentioned, a two-day session. It opened with remarks by Secretary Laird, Director Cowan, and Director Bonham. It was very well attended. I believe there were, I don't know, something like, well, there was 100 attendees, but I think there were like 80 tribes, if I remember right. I could be wrong on that number. The sessions were laid out to give as much information about Proposition 1, not just Chapter 8. So there was representatives from each of the other organizations that have responsibility for the other chapters in Proposition 1. So it started off, as I mentioned, with the director's level, and then there were representatives from each agencies. Commissioner Daniels was there for the commission, and then it went working down where I was on a panel and then Rachel were on a panel, and each panel getting successively more detailed about the specific programs. But the reaction from the audience was mixed. There were quite a few individuals who felt that it did not constitute a tribal consultation in the formal sense. They were felt it was strictly informational. They were not happy with it. In defense of those who put the meeting together, the goal of the meeting was to inform the tribes about what Proposition 1 had available, so if they wanted individual consultation on specific chapters, they would know who to go to and what to expect. In addition, calling it a consultation allowed the organizers to limit participation. So there wasn't broader members of the public in there, and it was very focused on tribal issues. Commissioner Daniels did offer to have roundtable meetings with specific tribes that were interested, and after she left, a number of the other agencies made the same offer. It was left that the responsibility is on the tribes to contact us if they want to have a meeting. That commissioners may want to reach out a little more, but I would caution that there are 540 tribes in California that all have sovereign nations, so it would be government to government, etc. There is an opportunity to do a slightly more manageable scale in that, at least as far as the federal tribes go, and there are about 160 federal tribes, they have organizations that represent Northern, Central, and Southern California. A individual that represents the chairs of those tribes. So that way there could potentially be three meetings that would encompass a number of tribes, but still that would leave the bulk of the state-recognized tribes still to be addressed. So meetings that we have coming up. There's another Stakeholder Advisory Committee meeting in July, the commission meeting, which we've talked about, another public workshop, and then at the end of July, the end of the public meeting series. On July 23rd, there's a state and federal agency coordination meeting, August 5th, another Stakeholder Advisory Committee, and the next meeting, the commission outside of Sacramento, will be in Los Angeles on August 19th.
Mr. Daniels.
Thank you. I did want to just make two different areas of comment. So one with respect to the tribal consultation. And I wanted to explain to my fellow commissioners the reason I offered a roundtable. You're probably aware that the tribal consultations are seen by the tribes as a government-to-government meeting. And the I think, understanding of how the consultations work is that it is like heads of state meeting, and there are meant to be discussions around issues of common concern. So as Ms. Landis mentioned, the goal here, because there's so much information, apparently, and how this was designed, was to at least get the information to those in attendance so that they could then understand how to interact better. But that's why there was this question about whether it was a true consultation versus an informational meeting. I've mentioned this to you all before, but I am a registered Native Hawaiian, and there's a lot I've learned from, you know, that whole process of being a registered Native Hawaiian. It's different from being from Hawaii. I actually am descended from what they say in Hawaii is Kanaka Maoli, which is the indigenous peoples of Hawaii, and there's a registration process. Hawaii is not recognized for a number of political reasons. So I just have some family history with understanding some of the concerns around those different statuses and expectations regarding communications, which is what I was reaching to in suggesting that if the tribes were interested, that we could sit down and have a discussion, rather than it be called a formal consultation, because a formal consultation might invoke government-to-government processes, but in order to have a true discussion. Granted, it's complicated because there's a number of tribes and a number of different issues we're all dealing with. I'm just would be happy to offer some help in trying to figure out what the best approach might be to make sure that at least our purview is addressed with the tribes that are interested. And I'm going to imagine that it's mostly going to be in the northern, very northern areas.
Yeah, thank you. That's appreciated. And I do have a call into Anna Sita, who's a tribal coordinator for DWR, to try and sort some of this out. I'm sure we'll have good suggestions for how we can approach it.
The other question I had was on a different topic, is stakeholder comments. As I noticed in our packet that there's some letters, some correspondence, and this may or may not fit into this particular topic, but this is where I thought I might at least try to ask about it. There's comments from NRDC, Plumas County Building and Services, and California Water Fix Coalition, and some specific comments I noted on some of these letters, and I was wondering how you are going to incorporate or respond to them. And if need be, I can walk through the ones that I'm curious about, but I just thought I'd ask you generally.
So I can respond to that stuff. This is actually part of a batch of letters that came in from mostly members of the Stakeholder Advisory Committee, and staff is in the process of sorting through those comments and finding a way to provide them that summarizes the key issues, and we'll plan on bringing you all of the relevant comments in a summarized and usable format at the July meeting.
And then some of them are fairly substantive, so would we be deciding them, or are staff going to make some preliminary decisions and recommendations, or what? Well, I'll just give you an example. In the NRDC one, there's a few that I noticed are very substantive, including taking the Shasta enlargement off the list of eligible projects. The other was some very specific comments on definitions, and then also having two PSPs as an example.
I think we would propose a draft, and then the commission would look at it. The draft replies obviously would go out under the signature of the chair.
So, you mean draft revisions?
No, draft responses to the comments.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there anything further on this discussion? Does that conclude item 10? It does, huh? Kind of went right into that. So are we going to be taking a break now? A little ahead of schedule here, man. We're breezing through this.
Okay.
Excuse me. If you would like, Tracy could tee up the afternoon session, although I think lunch is here, right? It will be here any minute, but Tracy can do the introduction for our afternoon session.
Okay.
Okay, Tracy, you want to do that?
Okay, I have a series of slides that is basically in response to Commissioner Daniels' request for more detail on what would, if you need to take a break, that's fine. Okay, so I, when you guys are tired of listening to me or lunch shows up, just put up, you know, let me know to stop, and then we can pick up at the in the afternoon session. So really what I'm going to take you through is a quick walk through the guidelines. So the three things I have for the afternoon session are going through the guidelines and the proposal solicitation package outline, talking about some constraints on the on a grant program, and also talking about possible funding for environmental documentation and permits. And so we'll probably focus in on the guidelines portion this morning. Right now, so basically, we've typically have guidelines and proposal solicitation packages, and they can be two separate documents or one document depending on how you set up the program. I think our background assumption is if we're going to be running this collectively as a single solicitation, we would have a document that includes all the proposal solicitation package. So we'd be coming to you with a single package of documents. And we have typical large sections such as an introduction and overview, and I'll go into some of the content on those various sections. So we would have a general overview of what the program is, have some of the basic rules of how much funding is available, cost share requirements, and program preferences. We would then talk about the eligibility requirements, and what we're trying to do in the guidelines is make this a useful document that the applicants can read, and it's more of a guidebook for them to know whether they're eligible and how they're going to be evaluated. So we'll have our code from Proposition 1, we'll have our regulations, and the guidelines is really maybe the user's manual on the grant program. We have a list of general program requirements that may not be in Proposition 1 that come out from other practices, such as a confidentiality waiver. So when applicants submit their application, the guidelines will tell them that they are waiving any confidentiality requirements. And that is something where, depending on the nature of the program, there may be aspects where the Commission wishes to provide some level of confidentiality. For example, for the period of when the application is under review, the areas of sensitivity for the applicants are typically if there is an acquisition, they may not want it being public record on which properties they're looking at for the acquisition issues, either because they're still negotiating a price or they don't haven't secured interested parties. So the proposal the selection process, this is where we really start laying out the process steps, how we're going to notify people of various solicitations, such as the pre-application and the full application, how what the caseworker that we are considering having, what type of workshops we'll provide for assistance, what our review process is, how we're going to notify the commission. And then we also generally in the guidelines have a list of appendices, useful web links, a compilation of the definitions, the guidelines for grantees. This is more along the lines of the documentation you have to maintain for auditing purposes for the grant funds. For the proposal solicitation package, if it's set out as a separate document, we may reiterate some of the statements, or if it's a single document, they could be shorter. And this is really getting more into the detailed process of here's how we're going to evaluate your application, here's how you're going to be ranked. And here's the schedule of when things are due.
Tracy, could I interrupt you there and ask a question?
Sure.
Could you explain to the commission the value of having a combined guideline and PSP versus two separate documents?
Typically, when we have separate documents, like for the IRWM grant program, where we're doing multiple solicitations, we may try and have one set of guidelines that apply for multiple solicitations. So it gives you a lot of the administrative high-level stuff in a single document that you don't have to change. And the solicitation, the PSP really focuses in on those things that change, like what day the application is due on. But if it is a single, if this is going to be a kind of like a one-step process where we're trying to administer the entire amount of funding in a single solicitation because it is going to be long and complex, we could come out with a consolidated document that you have to just approve at one time, and it lays out the whole process. So it's one of those, it's a discretionary call on what looks good at the time that you're getting ready to do your solicitation. So the PSP starts talking about, the who, what, where, when. So what do they need to submit? What application attachments? Are they going to be giving us hard copies? Is it going to be electronic? If we have the pre-application that we talked about in the May meeting, we'll have the instructions for both the pre-application and the full application. We are presuming that we're going to do an electronic submittal. The more discretionary discussion is with the review time, or if these are going to be big documents, would the review team want to have hard copies as opposed to printing them out themselves? And a lot of the time it is just easier to get the hard copies from the applicants because then they can assemble it in a nice package that flows well as opposed to trying to print it out. We'll also provide them a checklist to make sure that they have everything they need. This is a list of the type of attachments that we would have. This is it's based on some of the information we covered in the flowcharts last month. It is subject to change. It may get longer, but we want to see that they're authorized to submit the application. We start looking at their feasibility study. So all those things that we need to evaluate in order to make a decision whether they're eligible are the things that the PSP would lay out. Here's what you put in the application, in the attachment for this topic. Here's how many characters or pages you have to present this information. Here's what you need to give us. We would also lay out, and this is one where it's, Paula, to kind of go circle back to the guidelines versus and separate versus combined document. If we're coming out with a combined document, the review and evaluation criteria may be part of the guidelines. So there's a lot of things that we'll figure out the specifics when we get the document together. But we'd have a review and ranking criteria laid out. We would have exhibits that would give them guidance on how to do the economic analysis, how to do the cost allocation issues, things along those lines. So that is basically the high-level overview of what would be in the documents. So if you have any questions or comments.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank you for the presentation in response to my request. I did actually, after the last meeting, go back and read the draft guidelines. I thought that might be helpful to me to inform the process, too, so I looked at that. But this is, I think, a really helpful way to summarize what's going to be in each area. So thank you for doing this, and I'm going to hang on to this.
You're welcome. And I think that the next draft of guidelines will look substantially different than the previous draft.
Same topic areas? What will change?
Some of the content, I think there'll be, it'll be a substantial redraft. So, the more effective use of the time may be to not spend too much time. It's nice to review it, but.
I reviewed it. I didn't.
Yeah. So wait for the next draft to study.
Okay.
When will we be seeing that next draft?
That's a good question. The guidelines in the PSP kind of compile all of the stuff that's being worked on. So you're seeing the bits and pieces over the summer. You know, we may just, you know, and that's where I think we have to sit down with staff and say, when's the best time to do it? But if we've got bits and pieces, do we just come in later and give you the whole combined package in one fell swoop, or do we feed you parts? We've got to get some of the real technical content in a good shape. The administrative content is pretty far along. So if you want it to more of the administrative concepts on like the general requirements and the language that we would typically use for things like the confidentiality waiver or conflict of interest, that's ready now. But the technical stuff, that's what's being worked on.
I'm not sure the commission, I could be wrong, wants to see like the confidentiality and all that kind of stuff. That's just
right. The easy
that's boilerplate. That's
right. The easy, and that's why it's ready to go.
Commissioner Quintero.
So I have a question, Tracy. When you indicate that there's a pre-application, is that the point at which you would assign a caseworker?
That's our assumption. Is once we've got to the point that we have decided, Here are the folks that are possibly coming in for actual money as opposed to the entire applicant pool.
Yep.
Okay. Prior to that, I think we would still have staff available to assist people.
Thank you. So are we on the CEQA responsibility? No.
I think it might be a good time to break for lunch. Okay. And when we reconvene, we'll be in room 143.